Welcome to Act in Line, the podcast of the Acton Institute for the Study of Religion and Liberty. I'm Caroline Roberts, producer and host. Since late May, many parts of the United States have been in a state of unrest. Anger over George Floyd's death sparked many protests, but later looting and violent riots also broke out. Protesters also began defacing and tearing down statues across the country, including monuments to Confederate leaders, but also monuments to George Washington, Union General Ulysses S. Grant, and even Winston Churchill in London. The Capitol Hill Autonomous Zone, now dubbed the Capitol Hill Organized Protest, has taken up six blocks in Seattle, where thousands of protesters have supposedly declared total liberation from policing. Many are calling this a revolutionary moment, but is it really? If so, what's driving it? How are Christians called to respond to the upheaval? On this episode, Acton's Samuel Gregg weighs in. Joining me on the podcast today is Samuel Gregg, the director of research here at Acton. Sam, thank you so much for coming on.
Caroline, it's great to be with you.
So, by just about everyone's standards, this has been a crazy year. The United States is still wrestling with COVID-19 and the economic fallout. But in the midst of that, we're also struggling with unrest. Because since George Floyd's death, healthy conversations about disparities that we're seeing that need to be addressed or practical steps to achieving police reform seem like they're being drowned out by chaos. So today I'd like to analyze with you some of what we're seeing. First off, one word I've heard so often to describe what's going on right now is the word revolution. For example, the Washington Post asked on June 4, quote, "Are we on the brink of revolution?" The Wall Street Journal also published a piece titled, "America Doesn't Need a New Revolution." And people are even drawing comparisons to the French Revolution, and a few people even drawing comparisons to the Chinese Cultural Revolution. So in your opinion, is that an accurate word to describe what we're seeing?
In my view, no. It's certainly a type of cultural, social, and civil unrest. But revolution implies something very different. It implies an effort to completely reorder politics, economics, cultural expectations, etc. Now, there's no question that there are plenty of groups out there that would like to see that type of widespread systematic change sweeping across the United States. But there's a couple of things that make me hesitate before describing it as a revolution. One is that most people are not in revolt. If you look at the United States, the people who are out in the streets, who are demonstrating, who are protesting, and all these things, it's not as if they're somehow representing a majority of the population, or that a majority of the population are out in the streets saying something is fundamentally wrong, we need to overturn the constitutional arrangements of 1776 and 1788. We're not seeing that type of mass movement. We're not seeing anything like what happened in France in 1789 in terms of the sheer scale of the unrest. We're not seeing anything like the type of uprisings that we saw throughout Europe in 1848. We're not seeing anything like the Russian Revolution of March and then October 1917. What we are seeing, I think, is something much more akin to what we saw happen in France and other Western countries in May 1968, where you have, if you like, a type of generational upheaval. And even there, I don't think that most people between the ages of 20 and 30 are out in the streets protesting. It's a particular category of people who are doing that. But I think that's much more what we are seeing. And that doesn't mean it's not serious. It is serious. The point, however, is that I don't think we're on the brink of some sort of revolutionary upheaval in the sense that we've seen in the past. I also do wonder how long some of these protests will be able to sustain themselves. Part of it, I think, is a result of people having been locked down for a long time, which means that they want to get out, their tempers are shorter, they're less inclined to think rationally about all sorts of things, all of which I completely understand. But sustaining protests for week after week or month after month, which is what we saw in the case of France in 1789 or in Europe in 1848 or America, for that matter, in 1776, I just don't see that. What is happening, I think, is the expression of a fair amount of legitimate concern about anything ranging from questions of equality or economic equality to the behavior of some law enforcement officials, etc. But we don't see, I think, across the board, across every segment of society, a fundamental rejection of, in the case of America, the constitutional arrangements that have been in place since the late 1780s.
So regarding why we're calling it a revolution, do you think that's because we don't know the historical meaning of the word, or are we perhaps overestimating the situation?
I think it's partly because we overuse the word revolution. You pick up a newspaper or if you go online and you'll see revolution, 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 tech revolution, cultural revolution, revolution in politics, whatever. It's an overused word, which I think has essentially emptied it of the real significance of its meaning. People, I think, mix up social upheaval with revolution. They mix up the expression of widespread discontent with revolution. Now, the one thing I think that is maybe giving it that type of flavor is that it's very clear that while there is a spontaneous dimension to some of this, it's also very clear that some of what we're seeing on the streets in different parts of the country and in Europe, it's quite organized. It's not some sort of spontaneous uprising of the people. Have a look at a lot of the people who are demonstrating. If you look, for example, at some of the groups who associate themselves with Black Lives Matter, I read one estimate the other day that five out of six people who support Black Lives Matter as an organization are white, young white people. So I think there's a fair amount of organized agitation that's going on, which is normal. That's what happens in these particular circumstances. But I also think it's really we've lost a sense of what a true revolution actually looks like. And that may be reflecting a certain degree of historical amnesia about these sorts of things. Because a revolution means fundamentally overthrowing the existing political and constitutional order. That happened in France in 1789. It happened in Russia in February, March 1917. But it's not happening right now. I do think you can say that we're seeing a fair amount of cultural dissatisfaction being expressed on a number of different levels, which makes it much more similar to what we saw in May 1968 in France. But that's a very different situation from what I think is an authentic revolutionary moment.
Well, you mentioned earlier that, you know, all of these protests and riots, they all are made up of many different concerns, some of which are, of course, legitimate. And there's a lot of different debates and concerns that are being blurred together or merged together. So can you perhaps pick those apart for us? Where do you see questions and concerns being perhaps merged with others in an unfair light?
Well, what I do see, for example, is obviously there's a fair amount of social tension that has been generated by the fact that the country has been forced into indoors, so to speak, for considerable periods of time. We're also seeing that overlapping with the fact that we have one of the highest unemployment rates in the country. And it came on very quickly And if it wasn't for the pandemic, I don't doubt that unemployment would be still at 3.5%, which was an incredibly low number. Then you have the protests against what's seen, often rightly, as the use of excessive force by the police. We're also seeing, I think, the fruits of what is being taught in a lot of what used to be called the humanities once upon a time. We have a lot of people who are going to college, who are studying degrees, which are essentially exercises in not what I would say describe as sort of the legitimate critique that anyone should go through when they're going to university and studying. They need to ask questions about why the world is the way it is, et cetera, et cetera. That's fine. But what we've seen happening, I think, for a while now is, frankly, I think in many cases, a type of indoctrination into particular ideologies that's been going on in, I would say, a good number of universities, particularly in the humanities departments. So when you go to college and you're told month after month, year after year, that everything is unjust, that particular groups rule the country for particular reasons, when you're told that nothing is as it seems, when you're told to awaken your consciousness, which I guess is where the phrase woke comes from, right? When you're told you need to awaken your consciousness to the real realities around you, which is a classic Marxist way of trying to understand social reality, by the way, then we shouldn't be surprised that we see people saying things about the current state of affairs which do have this type of rhetoric of we need fundamental upheaval now, and we don't really care what it looks like on the other side. We just need to overthrow the established order as it is. So those, I think, are just some of the particular movements that we see happening. They often don't, I think, have a great deal to do with each other. Some of them blend with others. Some of them overlap with others. And, of course, you have the backlash against a lot of this, which is currently starting to emerge now, whether in terms of people expressing deep frustration with the fact that they've been told to socially distance, and yet it's okay for lefties to go and demonstrate en masse on numerous times during times when they're supposed to be locked down. So you can see that there's a whole set of resentments that start to come into play, particularly from those who have done everything that's been asked for them, and then see politicians and others marching in the streets, observing no social distancing rules, observing none of the protocols that everyone else has been following. I know people who have had family members die during this particular period, some from corona, some from other causes, who were not allowed to be with their loved ones at their last moments. But it's okay to go and protest en masse and not be and not suffer the sanction of the law for breaking the protocols that have been put in place for dealing with the pandemic. So you can see why all these different factors are at work. They crash into each other. And so we shouldn't be surprised to see increasing polarization going on in these type of circumstances.
Now, in the midst of this unrest, also a lot of us have seen statues being defaced or torn down, some Confederate monuments, but other statues have been torn down that don't make sense. For example, Ulysses S. Grant's statue was toppled in San Francisco, and he was a Union general who helped bring about Confederate defeat. In Madison, Wisconsin, protesters tore down a statue of the abolitionist Hans Christian Hegg. Even the Black Lives Matter organization leader Sean King called for all European images of Christ to be destroyed. Reverend Ben Johnson wrote in an article for Acton that, quote, "The heroes of U.S. and biblical history have been reduced to nothing more than slave owners or apologists." So what does this say about our understanding of human nature?
Well, one thing I think the phenomenon of statue tearing down points to is, and I think it comes out in the way that you posed the question, frankly, the sheer ignorance of people. When people are tearing down statues of the general who played such a big role in the defeat of the Confederacy, who was involved in the freeing of slaves, and they're tearing statues of Ulysses S. Grant down. That strikes me as one deep historical illiteracy, which I think is widespread among many of these movements. A second, I think, is that when people look at things like monuments, there's a lot of different things that are going on when particular monuments were put up at particular points in time. And I think there's a lack of appreciation of the fact that when you put up a statue to someone like a Churchill, for example, whose statue in London was defaced, for example, it's not that one endorses everything that that person said or did in their entire life. It's recognition of some type of fundamental contribution they made, which we as a society want to honor. So in the case of Winston Churchill, what is being honored there, what is being honored is the fact that he had the courage to stand up and say no to appeasement, to say no to the prospect of doing a deal with Nazi Germany in 1940, when many people would have said that it was entirely reasonable to do so. There are all sorts of views that Churchill had, which are not particularly palatable or popular, or even views that we would be particularly enthusiastic about endorsing today. But I think if you look at most of these people, you see they're flawed human beings like the rest of us. So the notion that we're not going to put up statues to anyone unless they completely fit a particular ideology strikes me as highly problematic. And when you go down that path, by the way, you end up with situations like you see in former Marxist countries, where you see these statues of Lenin and Marx everywhere. So I think it speaks to historical illiteracy in many cases. And why should we be surprised? Because if you're learning cultural Marxism at university, you're not actually learning history. It's a lack of appreciation of the subtleties that surround everyone's life, that none of us are perfect, that all of us have done and said things we regret. But also, I think, we should be looking at these statues as an opportunity to educate ourselves in the meaning of particular events in history so that we can discuss these things. So for example, when you see statues of Washington and Jefferson, okay, yes, they did own slaves, but they also played immense roles in the American Revolution and the establishment of the Constitution of the United States, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. When we look at these statues, they're a moment for us to educate ourselves in the complexities and some of the realities of human history. That great men, and someone like Washington, I think, is a great man, is not a flawless man. So I think that this unwillingness to look at these things and say, you know, maybe there's things that we can learn from this, strikes me as another example of this effort to try and whitewash our history of all its complexity.
What is it, what hallmark of the ideology that students consume in school do you think leave them to deny, like Alexander Solzhenitsyn said, that the line between good and evil runs through every human heart? What is it about the ideology that leaves them somehow to deny or just be blind to that?
Well, I think in many cases what we're talking about is a type of secularized form of religion. And it's a secularized form of religion that seeks to realize the eschaton in the here and now. There were T-shirts, I'm told, in the 1970s that people would wear saying things like, don't immanentize the eschaton. And what it means is, it's always a mistake to believe that you can create heaven on earth, that you can somehow create the end times in the here and now, that you can build a perfect world in this world. And I think that is what drives a lot of some of the ideologies that we see fueling much of the protest and much of the discontent that we see throughout the United States and other Western countries these days. So what that means is that if you think that you can create a perfect world in the here and now, then you're not particularly interested in the fact that there is this radical tension in all human beings, in the sense that we know what is good, but nonetheless we are drawn towards evil, as Paul tells us, right? And Paul tells us this. So religions that try to immanentize the eschaton are trying to create perfect human societies, and they're trying to create human beings that are free of any blemish whatsoever. And guess what? You can't do that. You can't do that without going down the path of taking the sorts of measures that we saw in places like Cambodia during the Pol Pot's reign there, China during the Cultural Revolution, and I have to say, in the immediate aftermath of the Bolshevik Revolution in Russia, where there was this attempt to sort of erase the past and create literally a new type of human person. But you can't change human nature. That's one thing that a lot of intellectuals have great difficulty in accepting. And if you can't change human nature, attempts to do so usually end up going very, very bad.
In attempting, as you know, Christians, to realize that human nature, it will always be with us. It is fallen. But at the same time, justice is to be pursued. How are those, I guess you could say, reconciled?
Sure. Well, I think that Christians, for example, believe that the ultimate realization of time is to be found in heaven, right? So this is how one thinks about it, that you can't realize a perfect world in the here and now. What you can do, however, is strive to work towards, let's call it, relative justice. And I don't mean by that relativism. What I mean is a type of acceptance that we do not live in a perfect world, that human beings and human nature are not perfect, they are imperfect, that we suffer from imperfections, that there are many things about society which reflect the fact that we are somewhat ignorant beings in many ways. And to that extent, we're often looking for the least imperfect of several imperfect realizations of justice that can be realized in the here and now. And that's hard for people to see and sometimes to accept, but it's not hard to understand if you accept that ultimate justice ultimately belongs to the divine creator, and that we ourselves are not the divine creator. Therefore, we have to settle in this world, in the temporal order, for a certain degree of relative justice, a certain degree of a type of relative approach to understanding things like politics and the workings of the law. If you go use these things and look at these things and regard them as mechanisms for creating a perfect world, then you end up with a lot of problems. If, however, you regard these things as good in many respects, but also marked by human flaws and human imperfection, then I think it becomes easier to reconcile this tension between the reality of who we are as human beings and the sorts of call that Christians have to make the world a better place. A better world, a more just world, doesn't mean a perfect world, because you can't have a perfect world as long as human beings are imperfect, and they will always be imperfect because human beings, whether we like it or not, are not gods and goddesses.
It seems to me that so many times when humans pursue their own definition of justice, there is a habit to pursue it in a sort of Manichaean way, not keeping eternity and temporal reality in sight, either focusing just on the eternal or just on, you know, the here and now.
Right. Right. I think that's true. That's the temptation that everyone faces at some type of level, because you can't be a faithful Jew or a faithful Christian, for example, and say, we can create heaven on earth, because those two religions make it very clear that there is no heaven on earth. But at the same time, those two religions do call upon people to work for some type of justice in this world, which means that you can't look at the world and say, well, things are really bad, but the only thing I have to worry about is the end times. And as long as I think about that, then I don't have to worry about obvious signs of injustice around me. So Judaism and Christianity have a particular way of threading that specific needle, in the sense that it rejects the idea that you can both reject the idea that you can create heaven on earth. But they also reject the idea that the impossibility of heaven on earth means that you can do nothing about injustices around you. So again, I say, I think that these religions point to the need for acceptance that we must pursue justice. People must pursue justice. Legal systems must be just. Political systems must be just as far as is humanly possible. And by that, of course, I mean as far as is we can recognize the fact that because we as human beings are imperfect, there's going to be a certain degree of imperfection about the political systems and the justice systems in which we live. Now, I think if you are a believing Jew or a believing Christian, and you take what these faiths teach about these questions seriously, I don't think that's a particular problem. I think if you are a person who reduces religion to a type of secular ideology, which I think is what we're seeing a lot of now, then you're going to be very disappointed, but you'll also do a lot of damage. On the other hand, if you're the sort of person that just washes their hands of all concern for justice, then I think you've basically opted out of having a positive contribution to make to politics, to economic discussion, and to reflection on the social order.
Now, we've been touching, of course, on how Christians can respond to these larger conversations in a more abstract way. But I'm wondering if we can boil it down to some more concrete or practical steps that you see all of this being embodied. How can Christians respond both out of humility and love, but also with courage? What does that look like?
Well, a couple of things. Well, one is to offer the wisdom of this religious tradition when it comes to thinking about the political order. Christian thinkers, right from the very beginning, so right from when Christ says, give to Caesar what belongs to Caesar, and to God what belongs to God, right from when St. Paul talks about the need to obey the emperor, but also you don't worship the emperor, right from the very moment that Christian thinkers from the first century, from the first decades of Christianity, were engaging with Greek and Roman philosophical positions and trying to show how some of these positions, not all, but some of them could be ways in which one brings the world of faith and reason together. In other words, Christianity has an enormous amount of wisdom to offer the world, regardless of whether people are believers or not, about the nature of politics, the ends of politics, what you can expect from politics and what you cannot expect from politics. So that's one thing, that sort of long-established historical memory of these things. So that's one question. Another thing I think is the obvious one, of course, is that all human beings are made in the image of God, which means that if you are a serious Christian, it's impossible to be a racist. But it also means that you can't view the world through the lens of race. You can't give the race this type of mediating lens by which you understand everything, because for the serious Christian, I think, skin color is simply an accident. It's got nothing to do with who you are as a human being. Yes, it has something to do with your particular identity as who I am, who you are, who all sorts of people are. But Christianity should remind us that ultimately all mankind is one. And that's extremely important, I think. I think another thing that Christians can offer is to stress that we don't settle some of these very real problems by simply emoting about things. And I see a lot of rampant sentimentalism driving a lot of what we're seeing. Now, people naturally and rightly get angry when they see injustice. They naturally and rightly get angry when they see corruption, or they see that political leaders are not doing what they said they would do, or they see that government officials are pursuing pretty much their self-interest rather than the common good. That anger is completely understandable, but it doesn't in itself resolve the problem. The problem, I think, the problem that needs to be addressed, I think, can only be addressed if we think about this from the standpoint of reason. And there's not a lot of reason going around right now. There just isn't. And Christianity, precisely because it takes reason so seriously, I think, Christians should be saying, look, we have thought about these questions for a very, very long time. Here's some of our religious wisdom about these questions, and here's some of the insights that are offered by what's often called natural law into how we deal with any number of problems of politics and justice.
What are some of those resources that we can offer up that help people continue thinking about to what extent ideology and what ideologies are playing a role in what we're seeing right now, as well as Christianity and justice? What books can you recommend?
Well, there's all sorts of books that one could recommend. In terms of understanding some of the racial side of what we're seeing going on now, I would very much recommend pretty much anything that has been written by our Acton colleague, Anthony Bradley. He's written extensively on many of these questions for a very, very long time, long before some of these particular events started to unfold across the United States. And I think that Dr. Bradley brings a very sound approach to thinking through these things that is informed very much by his Christian faith, but also by his reason. So I would very much recommend anything written by him. I'd also recommend, this may sound a little controversial to some people, I would also recommend reading Thomas Sowell, S-O-W-E-L-E, or listening to him. He's 90 years old now, but he has written extensively about some of the particular racial challenges facing the United States. And let's just say that his perspective and analysis and solutions is not at all part of what you're seeing on television when you hear people being asked what should be done. You can be pretty sure that Thomas Sowell will be offering some very different perspectives from what we're commonly hearing. And I happen to think that his perspectives, including when it comes to the economic dimension of many of these protests and the deeper dissatisfactions that they reflect, I think Thomas Sowell has a great deal to say that would be very bracing for many people to read when it comes to thinking about these issues of racial tension.
Sam, thank you so much for coming on. This was really a joy speaking to you today.
Thank you very much, Caroline. Great to be with you.
Thank you for listening today. If you like this episode, help us bring more attention to the show by sharing it with a friend or leaving a comment wherever you're listening. If you have a question for our team or feedback for the podcast, you can reach us at actinline@actin.org.